Let's go ahead and jump into our study. We didn't finish the lesson last week, but we made some pretty good headway, I think. And basically, where we're at in Exodus now, the children of Israel have come to Mount Sinai in chapter 19, and that sets the stage. God's telling them what he's going to do, and they got to get cleansed and all this. And then in chapter 20, God starts delivering the law to Moses. And the first thing we saw last week was, of course, what? What does he start with? The Ten Commandments, right? He starts speaking to Moses, says, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then he starts giving these commandments. So that was the first 17 verses. And again, this is the first of multiple deliveries of the Ten Commandments. This is also recorded for us in Deuteronomy as well. As we're going to see tonight, after God speaks the Ten Commandments, he's going to give some information about something else. We'll read those first few verses. But then there's several chapters of laws that are given. And really, most of those you can relate back to the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments are kind of the big, broad things, if you will, but then there's a lot of kind of, what if this happens and that happens? So the legal code fleshes that out. And then after that, we're going to start seeing God is going to deliver all these specific instructions about the tabernacle, right? So it just kind of struck me this afternoon as I was reviewing over what I had wrote down last Wednesday. There's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of movement taking place in Exodus, obviously. But once you get up to 19, it's like a lot of it's happening right there. A lot of, a big chunk of the rest of the book is, God speaking to Moses at Mount Sinai and then him delivering it. So we've come all the way to Mount Sinai, but we're going to be there for a while. We're going to be there for a while because there's a lot of chapters about not only the laws, but about the different things in the tabernacle, how that's going to be set up, what the priests are going to do, all these kinds of things we're going to see. Okay? So let's finish up chapter 20 first. We went up through verse 17. And so we need to read 18 through 26 and finish up that chapter before we get to some more of the specific laws. So does someone want to read 18 through 26 of chapter 20 to finish out that chapter?
Yeah.
Okay.
So 20 and start at 17, right?
18. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that the commandments. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we will listen. But do not let God speak to us, lest we die." Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. And the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make God of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not
all right, so God has delivered these commandments to Moses now, and then the people are receiving those. And what is the people's reaction to this? It's fear, right? They're afraid. And again, as kind of talking about earthquakes and everything, I mean, there is a lot going on here in Mount Sinai, right? There's trumpet blasts, there's lightnings, there's the earth shaking. So I mean, this is a pretty intense scene. And then on top of all that, God is speaking here. So they are very afraid. you know, there's like, okay, Moses, you can relay this, but we don't want to get too close to God. This is a little scary here. Okay, and Moses says to them the most repeated command throughout the Bible in verse 20 when they say they're afraid. He says what?
Fear not.
Fear not. He says, fear not. Okay? And you know, this is God delivering his word to us. So then there is another thing here that a couple other things that are instructed here before the chapter ends. This is number 10 in the question number 10. What does God tell Moses next before he starts going through all these laws in 21?
Not to worship, not to make idols.
Right, don't make idols. That's kind of a repeat of what he said before, but here he specifically says don't make them of silver or gold, which they're going to do before too long, right? Okay, so the commandments talk about not making these graven images, not making these idols, but here God is repeating that very specifically saying don't make gold or silver idols, because that's a common, we see this in the world today, we see it in the Old Testament. Many times people build these idols out of silver and gold, right? Because those are precious metals, they're shiny, they're impressive, you know, and so that's what God says. And you contrast that, okay, you think of someone making this big statue of a false god out of gold. What does God also tell Moses about next?
An altar.
But what is this altar going to be made of? Earth or rocks, basically. Not hewn stone. So in contrast to the fake gods, whose representation is pretty impressive looking, right, of gold or silver, God says, well, you're going to make an altar here, but just make it out of dirt. Make it out of the ground, or make it out of rock, stone, but don't, hewn them or anything. You know, just rocks. And he also says, make it on flat grounds, because you're not supposed to go up a bunch of stairs to get to it. So the contrast here is pretty stark between what God is saying at this point and, you know, what the false idols are. Dick, did you have a comment with that?
Yeah, it seems that God's saying that, you know, be humble. When we think about the temple in Jerusalem, Herod's temple,
yeah,
why? I mean, it should be God's temple. Mm-hmm. It should have nothing to do with Herod. But so he's saying that if anybody does a work of art, don't get credit for it, because I made all this stuff.
And right.
Just use what I made, and that's your altar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty simple, instructions here. Now, again, later we'll get the tabernacle and everything, but even that was portable, God's house is portable, But then later we do get the temple, and especially, we get to, the temple Herod was financing in the New Testament. Yeah, it's pretty ornate, And again, I'm all for, nice, pretty structures and everything. You've been to some beautiful churches, but I think there is kind of a line that, you cross at some point from, wanting to have something nice and honoring to God and just extravagance, especially when you look at certain places where the people are far from rich, and then, the church has all the money. It's just kind of something about that. If people are living in huts, and then you go into the church and the ceiling's made out of gold, how nice is that, It's like, maybe we're missing something here. But certainly I have seen many beautiful church buildings, but God is saying here, this is a simple altar. Now, it's kind of interesting here that God, after he gives them these commandments, and they've all agreed to follow them, okay, God says build an altar. What happens on the altar? Sacrifice. So why would God say to give these instructions about how to build altars? Why would he do that? What does that tell us?
That he decided that they could sacrifice.
Okay, we haven't even really got all the specific directions yet. Other than, the Passover, they sacrificed the lamb, but the whole temple system, that's going to come later. But we're kind of maybe previewing that a little bit. But why is that? Why would God put this out here right away, maybe, about them having these altars for sacrifice right after he gives the commands?
Well, he knows that nobody.
That's what we wanted to
get. Going to sin.
Yeah, despite their promises, right? God knows they're not going to keep these commandments. Right? He knows they're not going to. So we're going to need some altars with some blood sacrifice going on to, remember, the altar's not forgiving the sins, but to cover the sins, right? We talked about that a lot last year. So we already see that, you know, God in the distant witnesses, they're not going to keep this. So we got to be ready for the altar sacrifice here. So God, you know, because again, it would say, well, God gave all these commandments, they agreed to, everything's good now, right? Why are we talking about altars and sacrifice for sin? Well, because he knows they're not going to do it, okay? So eventually we will get to this whole elaborate sacrificial system, but this is kind of, I think, a preview of that, where God's already saying, this is how you should build the altars, because I know you're going to need them. I know you're going to need them, you know? So, be ready for that, you know? It's not a question of if, it's just when, and, you know, we're going to need this here, so. Let's see if there's anything else with that section there. I think that pretty much covers it. Alright. Now, we're going to chapter 21. Okay, which is still in this other lesson. He's just basically got like a paragraph in there, a few questions. But as I was looking at this chapter and looking at the next lesson, which is chapters 22 and 23, kind of some things, you know, I was trying to kind of look for some things you can tie all this together. Because when you're just reading through here, it's just like a bunch of laws, one after another, right? Boom, boom, law, next law, next law, next law, next law. These are parts of the Bible that people usually do what with?
Skip.
Yeah, they skip. All right, it's okay. So it's like that people don't realize, okay, the Exodus happens like in the first half of all this stuff with the plagues, all that, that's just like less than half, okay, before you get there. You know, there's just a lot of God speaking things in Exodus, the second half of it. So, yeah, you know, when you get to these genealogies or all these Old Testament laws, those are the parts people just skip over. Oh, there's no value there, let's just skip over that. You know, that's Old Testament stuff. That's kind of, you know, what's the point? Who begat who and all this? Even in the lectionary, do you get much of this in the lectionary? The 3-year lectionary? Nope. I mean, you know, they could only pick so many portions of scripture in that 3-year lectionary, the 1 year even less, right? But, you know, you don't see a lot of that. I mean, I think there's like, in the whole book of Leviticus, there's maybe like one or two readings in the whole 3-year lectionary. Because it's like all these laws. You know, there is one, because I remember I preached on this text one time, I was looking at the counter, I'm like, this might be like the only one. So I told Harris, you're getting a special treat today, a sermon on Leviticus. This doesn't happen very often if you follow the lectionary, okay? So people skip over a lot of these parts. But obviously, we've learned every little detail in the Bible has value, right? It's there for a reason. There's no kind of throwaway passage. There's not even throwaway words. I mean, you know, the more you study the Bible, you pick up these little details. Oh, okay, that's why that's there. So we don't want to just kind of fast forward through everything without even reading it. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe one of the reasons is we're not surprised by what's there. We already know all this stuff.
Well, a lot of it, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's some details, you know, we don't have an ox anymore, but, you know, some of the things about
right.
What you should and shouldn't do, I mean, we know all this. You know, we're made in God's image, and we know the difference between good and evil, and maybe we don't like to keep convicting ourselves.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, and I think when we did, several years ago, I think it's maybe before you guys came, we did a hermeneutic study called Herman Who, and that was one of the things he used from one of these chapters of the ox scoring the neighbor. You know, it's like, and those groups are like, what in the world does that have to do with, you know, a vast majority of the American population? I mean, who has an ox? You know, I mean, very few people, right, have an ox. And then, you know, it gores my neighbor, and then there's this bunch of, I mean, what does that have to do with me? But his point was, we can take principles from that, okay? So I want to spend a little bit of time just kind of, we did just look at, we just read last week the 8th commandment. We are in church, so I ask you a question. Have you guys read these 3 chapters yet?
Which one?
21 through 23?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, okay, good. All right, that's okay if you did.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. So there's a... So that's good because I want to kind of take those as a unit and look at some of the things before we even start going through them. So as we read them, there are some things we can look for. Okay, I thought that would be more useful. So that's good that you've read them, because then you'll know a little bit more what I'm talking about. But if you haven't and you're watching at home, read those three chapters all together, and then, you know, say, well, what are we learning from this? And then we can look at some specific stuff as we read them. But like I said, the next reading is all of chapter 21. That's what he's got here. It's reading the whole chapter. Okay? So these three chapters are primarily God giving laws to his people. Okay? So we look at chapters 21 through 23. They're mostly laws. I mean, that's a lion's share of what you're reading there. It's not until you get to the end of chapter 23, verses 20 through 33 of chapter 23, are God telling them what's going to happen when they get to Canaan. He's reiterating the promise and giving some more detail. You know, you're going to go into this promised land, you're going to defeat your enemies there and inhabit it. So, so that's not until verse 20, though, of chapter 23. The rest of them are pretty much all laws. Okay? Now, we've talked about this before. Really, when you talk about the law in the Old Testament, and you start thinking about how is that applicable to us today as Christians, we said there's really kind of three big categories of law. When you're reading your Old Testament, you see a law or a command, and you want to think to yourself, is it this, this, or this? Do we remember those? I got my all-star students here today, so.
Ceremonial.
Okay, yeah. So we got ceremonial.
Now, he calls it in here social order. But
yeah, that's
another name.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. All right. Ceremonial. Am I spelling that right or wrong?
Yeah.
Okay, ceremonial. All right. That's the way to check that. And then what else do we have?
I don't know what you call it. He called it social.
Okay. We're going to call this, I usually use the term civil.
Okay.
Like that. These are like the civil laws. Like on your way here, there was a posted speed limit. Okay. You know. All right. Then what's the third category? That's the moral. Okay. So again, when you're reading your Old Testament, and you get, this is, you know, important. I mean, again, there's two simple ways to do it. But I think this one is a little bit more exact. Like, one way is say, well, what laws apply to us as New Testament Christians? There's two simple ways. One way is you just strike through all of the Old Testament laws, every single one of them, and then you add them back in if the New Testament repeats it. Okay? The other way to do it is you keep every single Old Testament law, and you strike through them if the New Testament changes them, or they, you know, they're fulfilled. Okay? But I think this is a little bit more exacting way to look at it. And some of them, you know, will cross over categories, but it's important to understand. Now, okay, another review here. So we've talked about this. Which one of these three is binding for the Christian today?
Moral.
I kind of gave a little hint there. So I could have said which ones, but yeah, it's just one really moral. Okay? Alright? And we've said this before because the ceremonial law all pointed us to Jesus. Good. It's a good thing we studied this last year, right? We studied the book about Christ in the Old Testament. So they're all fulfilled. Can you do those things if you want? Sure. But you don't have to. Okay? Can you get circumcised and on the eighth day, can you not eat pork? Sure. Knock yourself out. But all that was pointing us to Christ. He's fulfilled it. The Sabbath, you know, Saturday Sabbath. Civil laws, we're not bound by those because we're not ancient Israel. He gave this legal code that we're going to start looking at. He gave it to his people in the Old Testament. He gave it to them. We have our own government and we have our own laws. Okay? Now, the difference is our laws can certainly be more skewed because God didn't directly speak them to Congress, right? Okay? All right? So, you know, God is giving them this law directly from on high. It says, so, you know, here it is. But the moral law doesn't change. All right, again, are we saved by the moral law? Of course not. Because we can't keep it. We have to be perfect. That's what we're going to hear Sunday if we want to be saved by the law, which is impossible. But the moral law is, why is it eternal? Why don't we just throw that out too? Some people are like, yeah, let's do that. It's a lot more fun. Get rid of all those other rules. No, because this is the nature and character of God. Right? That this doesn't change. God, he's never liked lying. He didn't like it in Exodus, and he doesn't like it now. And he doesn't do it. That's why it reflects the nature and character of God. So the moral law, again, not that we're saved by the law, not that we can perfectly keep it. No one can, as we're going to see Sunday in the sermon. That's when Jesus starts getting into that. Oh, you think you can keep the fifth commandment? Well, what about this? Okay? But this is still binding. All right. The Ten Commandments, which category do they fall into? We study them. This is in confirmation. Yeah, they're more. So the Ten Commandments are really the best expression of the moral law. So we still place a heavy emphasis on that. Now there's some ceremonial law in the Ten Commandments, especially related to the Sabbath. So again, some of these can bleed over a little bit. You say, well, what about the Sabbath? Our Seventh-day Adventist friends say, yeah, what about that? You still gotta do it. Okay, but we say, no, that's clearly ceremonial law because we studied this whole issue of the Sabbath, including what Jesus said about it, and it was clearly about Jesus. You know, even going back to God resting the creation week on the last day. I'm acknowledging that there is some ceremonial law here, but just overall, what we read last week, it's moral law. Okay, it's a moral code. Okay, these next chapters that we're reading here, 21 through 23, which category are they going to primarily fall into? Mostly civil. Yeah. So, you have a lot of civil law. Now, when I say civil, how do we know that it's civil law? Because it reads like a law book. It gives specific crimes and specific punishments, doesn't it? It is a legal code. I mean, this is the way the nation of Israel was to operate. Okay, this is your legal code. These are the laws. This is what's important. And even here are some specific punishments for these things. So, a lot of it there. Now, there is a little bit of ceremonial law as well. 23:10-19. So when we get into chapter 23, the first 9 verses are really civil law, like 21 and 22. But then you get to 10 and 19, and that's pretty much ceremonial law, because it's talking about what there? What was it talking about? If you read ahead, like I said, not really ahead, because we might get to it today, but this is about the feasts, right? And the feasts are part of the ceremonial law, right? Why did they have the feast? They all pointed to Jesus. Why are they supposed to remember Passover forever? Because it's pointing them to the Messiah, okay? So, it's mostly civil law, but it is some ceremonial. One thing I also found helpful as I was studying for this last Wednesday night, a lot of times after I leave, I'll stay and I'll start working, I'll work on the lesson for next week, so I can quiet here. And so, I'm reading it, as much as I love the King James Version, it was helpful to get a modern translation for these laws. They're hard enough as well. I read them in the King James, then I'm like, okay, what else I got on the shelf here? I'm reading the modern translation, and that helped a little bit. So it is just little words of the wise there. They're pretty difficult in the King James, because not only are you dealing with a legal code that's thousands of years old, now you're dealing with someone translating using legal terminology from hundreds of years ago, from Britain. So I found it kind of helpful to use some of the modern translations too. But, here's what we're looking at. So we've already answered that question, but that was one of the things I wanted to look at, make sure everybody is clear. Are we under these laws today? Only these. Only the moral. Okay, only the moral law. We are not under these laws today. Now that being said, oh, great, Pastor, I can just skip over these chapters then, right? Because he just said we're not under that law anymore. We can just skip over that. We don't even know that stuff. Happens with ox course, a neighbor, or a slave marries a child of the master or whatever. We don't even know that stuff. We're not under that law. Well, the thing is, again, all of God's word is important, but what can we take from these laws, especially these that we're looking at tonight? If we don't necessarily have to have the same exact punishment for every one of these crimes, what can we take from these civil laws?
It makes order in society.
Yes.
And it also shows you how people should interact.
Yes.
So
it's
still, the basic is there.
Yes.
It's just situations that maybe are a little bit.
Yes, exactly. Instead of an ox goring your neighbor, it's your Rottweiler pit bull goring your neighbor. Okay, I mean, yeah. So yeah, so that, and that's the point I want to hit on is here. Yes, we are not under the civil code of Israel because we are not ancient Israel. However, the principles that we see given in these laws are still in effect. So again, it's a little too convenient to say, oh, we're not under that civil law. But the principles that we're going to see here are still very much valuable and important and reflect things. I mean, God just didn't pull these things out of a hat, right? He gave these specific punishments for a reason, didn't he? Okay, Dick had a comment or question.
Well, I was just going to say, and there's really a connection in the moral law to the civil law,
yeah.
Because, you know, it says, well, thou shalt not bear false. Well, that's what happens when you do. The civil law says, this is, or thou shalt not steal. Okay, so you take a guy's stuff, and now you got to give him five times back.
Right.
You
know?
So right. There is a connection between those. Yeah, because right. What happens if you violate.
Well, the other thing we have to remember our Lutheran forefathers, you know, wrote extensively on this, and as I'm reading Luther's commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, which really is, he keeps coming back to this in the Sermon on the Mount, because people say, well, you know, okay, turn the other cheek, well then, do we punish anyone for a crime? We have to understand the proper distinction between the right and the left-hand kingdom. Okay, the church being the right-hand kingdom, the left-hand kingdom being the state. As, you know, we live as citizens of both that. So, you know, this is not the way it's worked in history all the time, but as we're learning in Sunday school, it usually goes sideways when we get mixed the roles. Does the church administer civil penalties for law? Is that our job? No. No, it is not. But we do have a government, and that's their job, right? So, someone breaks into a church and steals something. And let's say I see the guy running out of the thing, and I probably can't do this because he's probably faster. Let's say I nab him. Okay, I get him. Well, do I lock him up in my office and then Sunday bring him out before the church and say, this guy was doing this. What are we going to do with him? Off with his head or whatever. No. Okay, no. What's going to happen? I'm going to call the police, right? And they are going to put him into the criminal justice system, right? If we so choose to do that. So we have to remember this as well. Now, in Israel, what God is setting up here, there's not really a separation of church and state to use the commonality. It's all together here. Okay, but we do recognize there are roles for the church and the state. Because in the New Testament, it's kind of backwards from that, because did the church begin by government decree? No. They were kind of rebels, actually. Government didn't like them, okay? So it was certainly a separate role. You know, the great example is they try to trip Jesus up, as they always do, and pull out a coin with Caesar. Ah, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Because, you know, they're bad. And Jesus says, well, you know, whose head's on the coin? Caesar, all right? Well, render unto Caesar what Caesar. So Caesar has a role, and but then it's not the same role as it's God's people, okay? So we do need to keep that in mind too. Okay? So the principles apply, but the church is not the government. Okay? Now we can administer church discipline, right? But that's as far as it can go. I mean, we could, you know, you get all to the point where someone is excommunicated from the church. That's like the, you know, most serious thing. But are they going to get put in jail for that? No. Okay? They're not going to go and sit on the couch or whatever. Whatever, find another church to go to, probably is what usually happens, you know. But, so, we only can administer discipline, if you will, within that is not like what we think of as fines or community service or jail time or anything like that. Okay? Alright, so, we've established the principles are important here, even though we're not under this law. So, that begs the question then, what are some of the principles and the overarching themes that we draw from these three chapters? I came up with a short list. Maybe you have some others. I mean, the obvious one is, we're going to say, like I said, the themes of these chapters. The obvious one is, have a what? Have a government. Okay? know, God is saying there needs to be some type of system, right? You know, there are people who are anarchists, right? What does an anarchist believe?
No government.
No government is best. They say there's, no government, we don't need government, people should just take care of themselves, basically. And usually that is accompanied with a belief that people are good. You know, so that an anarchist will tell you, well, it'll work out because most people are going to do the right things. And you're like,
Let's
see how that works out for you. Yeah, so, there's, I guess it was not as popular now maybe, but years ago that was like a cool thing. Kids would wear like an anarchy symbol on their clothes or something. We used to have one teacher at Franklin County said, you guys don't even know what that is. You know what anarchy is? He said, if we had anarchy, you guys would be the first to go. You're the first ones they're going to come for. They're wearing this stuff, So God is for government, right? He's clearly laying a principle. And along with a court system, right? So there needs to be some kind of enforcement mechanism for people who get out of line. And it's a court system too, isn't it? They set up a court system. And we'll see, as you read through the Old Testament, there's even like protections, like two witnesses have to say. So you can't just have one guy going, I saw him do that, off with their head. No. There needs to be some evidence there. Okay, so that's the obvious here. God is okay with government. God's okay with government because this is basically what he's setting up here, a legal code for them to follow. Dick, you got one or comment on it?
400 years of judges, too.
Yeah, and the judges. Judges, right? Yeah. Okay, the other, Steve, y'all throw something out if you want. I thought I can give you the ones I came up with, but I mean, these are just me jotting them down as
restitution.
Right? That was one I put something / restitution, because if you're going to have restitution, that implies something else. What do a lot of these laws deal with? Stuff. How could we say that like in an American constitutional law kind of way? What we call
things
private
property.
Property. Okay? And I'm going to go ahead and put a / there and say restitution. Okay? So, God is okay with government. Is God okay with private property? Yeah. Seems like it. Now, you do see in the New Testament that Christians were sharing, right? Oh, that's socialism. Well, in a way, but it's not like the government was. There's a big difference in a group of people saying, well, we're going to share stuff, and the government saying everyone must share or go to jail. I mean, there's a little difference there, okay? But certainly there is a value in. What about coveting your neighbor's house and oxen? Things like that. Dude, don't steal. Well, why is it a big deal to steal? What's mine is yours, and my casa is su casa, right? Because obviously, if we say stuff like this, it's a something that works, right? So God is saying there are things, there's stuff that belongs to somebody. It belongs to somebody, and you can't just take it. So it's certainly not advocating for communism here. So we got anarchism, now we have communism. Does that mean advocating for? Because people are having property, and what you said there, Dick, with the restitution, so many of these laws, like if you damage someone's property, either intentionally or you borrow something and it breaks while you have it, you got to replace it. Okay? So if you're going to force people to pay restitution, then before you even get there, you got to understand, well, there has to be something that's theirs. Because you can't take something that's somebody's if it's not theirs, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
You cannot steal unless somebody owns something.
Exactly. If somebody owns it, you ain't stealing. Okay. Let's see if this is a. Oh, okay. I thought it was a question for class, but someone's gonna have homework for me after class. Take a picture of how many copies of pages left. So we see a lot of this has to do with private property and restitution, right? Okay? What else? Anything else?
Slaves.
Okay, we're going to look at that specifically, but what principles, though? What about why do we need to have these laws? Why isn't anarchy a good idea? Because some people are going to prosper under anarchy. Some people aren't. Most people aren't. So these laws continually are pointing us to protection for who?
People.
Well, let's
self-protection.
Protection for the weak is how I put it. Okay? The weak. People who can't defend themselves. I mean, if I'm 6'5", 250 pounds, and I've got lots of weapons, in an anarchy system, I might do okay. Especially if I've got a bunch of guys with me doing the same thing. Okay, if I'm a 90-pound soaking wet weakling who can't fight my way out of a paper bag, I'm probably not going to do so well. Okay? So we see in these laws protections for the weak. Okay? People who might be, someone could run roughshod over them. The widows and the orphans the Bible's always talking about, right? We talk about this a little bit more later. So some of the laws about divorce and a man taking a wife and things like that. We think about it in 21st century America and we're like, well, what's the deal with that? But at this time, if a woman's husband died or just decided to run off with somebody else, that woman was in bad shape. Okay? So there needed to be some kind of protections for that. Okay? There's protection for that. And this is, again, it's funny, the sermon always ties into what we're studying, but this is what Jesus, when he's talking about divorce in the Sermon on the Mount, what had happened is it was meant as a protection. They had to get this legal document to divorce. But what it had turned into by Jesus' time is, it was just a formality. A man could divorce a woman for anything, basically. But I got my sheet of paper. Got my sheet of paper. They're out of here. And so Jesus is saying, why is he so upset about this? Because this is really bad for people, especially women. And so if they just could be kind of kicked to the curb and then they're, out there in society. So without the opportunities that women have today. So there's protection of the weak. He even talks about the children and things like that. Okay? So God has always been concerned about the weak and the powerless. It talks about, again, a lot of this stuff cuts both ways on the football. It talks about being understanding about the, what we would say, immigrants today, the foreigners, the sojourners, doesn't it? Those would be people that would be seen as weak and not having a lot of power, right? It talks about that in this Mosaic law, doesn't it? Okay? So I think when I'm reading through these, I see so much of this is about protecting the weak. And that is the last one I had, and I think maybe some of you guys are leaning closer to it, is that why does God even care about protecting the weak? Because what is important?
They're important to God.
Human life, human life is important. It's important to God. Human life is very important to God. That's what I see when I read these laws. Okay? The punishments for taking someone else's life, are they harsher or weaker than taking someone's property? Harsher. First degree murder is death sentence. Okay? Alright? So, I mean, there's so much in there that shows you, okay, private property, restitution, all that's well and good, but it's people, really, that have the most protection under this. Okay? Alright, again, thinking about in our 21st century, you mentioned like the slavery or servant system. But if people have slaves, if there aren't these laws, some would say, well, it's my slave, I can treat that slave however I want. But the Mosaic law says, no, you can't. They even have rights. Okay? Alright, so human life, I mean, some say, well, it's a slave, a servant, who cares? They're just a machine, basically, we're using. Okay? But the principle here is human life is important. Okay? I think that's something that...
Is that along the way.
Yeah, we missed that along the way. Yeah.
We missed that big time.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So human life is important to God. Because again, you can look at these laws are protecting, we see, as the weaker people in society, and they're also, the punishments are much harsher if you do something that harms a person. Okay? Alright. Next question. Do we see principles from this civil law? Do we see those pretty prominently even today? Now remember, this is thousands of years ago, God is giving Israel this law. As you read through those laws, do you see a big carryover of that to today? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. It may not look exactly the same, like Mom said earlier. The punishments may not even be exactly the same. Okay, we don't have the death penalty for as much stuff now, okay? But think about the things. I mean, this is a big part of our system, right? Is private property crimes, isn't it? Okay?
Fair wages.
Fair wages. Yeah. Yeah.
Manslaughter,
yeah. Okay, so the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not murder, more literally. That's pretty, that's your moral there. But then these laws recognize all killing is not the same in every way. Yes, it involves taking a human life, which is tragic, but every taking of human life is not the same legally, is it, right? Okay, if a drunk driver tragically kills someone, there's a legal price to pay for that. But if someone plans out a murder in advance and secures all the things and has a plan and does it, they're going to be punished more harshly, right? Why? Because of the intent there. Okay? All right? So we see that. So these laws kind of flesh out. Okay, thou shalt not kill. What do we do here? Thou shalt not steal. What do we do here? Okay? All right, so I think, really these laws are the basis of law in modern society, especially in Western society, but even in, Middle East in some ways too. But I mean, you read through these and you see, we punish people for that. Or we have a protection for that. Okay? Someone has a dangerous animal and it keeps attacking people. The government can take that animal away from them by force and put it down. Well, you could argue and say, well, it's their animal and their property. Maybe people should have stayed away from it. Well, protection of the weak. Life is important, right? So God is saying, no, there has to be some accountability here for something like this. Okay? Last question, and then like I said, this is going to save us some time, I think, as we go through these, because we're getting kind of the broad things, I think, is what we want to take away from it. We kind of discussed this a little bit, and this isn't one we can just answer with a yes or no or properly resolve neat and tidy tonight, but I'll ask it anyway. What are we to make of some of the laws about things, slavery, the prime example, that we do not practice today?
They had specific laws that in some ways gave some protections to the slaves.
Yeah.
Not saying it
good, but
right
yeah.
to do. But there were some civil laws.
Yes. Legal protections for slaves.
Right.
It's kind of difficult to answer all this stuff, and I think even as a city guy, I don't have an answer for everything here, But I know this is what God said for them to do, so that was what was right and just for them to do, right? So, because that's what God told them to do, right? But I think with some of these things, one way I've heard it explained, is at least one way to look at it, that's maybe a little helpful. If these things existed, okay, these practices existed, and I guess God could have said, just ends today, which it probably wouldn't. But I mean, we don't know the mind of God and all things, but he could have said that. But it's almost like, well, if you got to have this, here's some rules. It's like divorce, right? The divorce is like, well, if it's going to happen, here's how it is. Polygamy. If polygamy God's design? Certainly. I mean, that's not what you read in Genesis. If that was God's design, he would have made like 5 women for Adam. Hey, look, you did 5 wives. All right. No, he made 1 wife, 1 woman, and he said that you will, you know, man and woman, a man will leave his father, his wife will leave mother, and then they will become one flesh. So obviously, somewhere along the line, people went off kilter with this. It doesn't say no more polygamy, period. But it does give some, if this is something that's going to happen, there needs to be some kind of, this can't be a free-for-all. Okay? There are some of those things that are different. Again, it's always hard. We live as 21st century Americans, okay? And there's different things going on in our society. Okay? But at the same time, we have to recognize this is what God's telling them to do. And some of these things can get a little thorny. But God is giving some guardrails for some of these practices, at least, if they're going to happen. And again, when you look at polygamy in the Old Testament, usually it didn't end well. I can't think of a time where it's used and it's like, this made things better. It was worse. You know, this is what happened. You know, there was some, you know, the trickery, you know, with Rachel and Leah and all this. Always something nefarious going on.
The women.
You notice it's always the man married a bunch of women, right? Okay, that's the way this happened. It's not the other way around. Y'all are too smart for that, right? But this, in slavery, since we're almost out of time, we're probably just going to lay the principles here today. But go ahead with your question or comment.
I'm just going to say usury is one we forget about.
Oh, usury, which is commonly called like interest, right?
Yeah.
Interest. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I've even read a couple things about this. I mean, there are certain of these things that we kind of, and it gets into some of the finances stuff too. Like, again, I think there's some equal offending if you're kind of more liberal or conservative politically that is brought out here. It's like, well, you know, you can argue, well, it's my money and they decided to do it. And if it's a bad deal for them, that's their fault. But is that what the Bible said?
No, God's trying to protect the poor.
The weak. Right. People not being taken advantage of. So this excessive interest idea, I mean, I think that's one, I mean, you don't really, I mean, I think of my own, I can't remember preaching a sermon against usury, but I mean, it's kind of those respectable sins that we have. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like that people just, you know, there might be an investment banker in the congregation, but touch that, you know. So, but again, there's a use for money and all this, you know, our financial system. But I think, again, the principle there is you are not to take advantage of people who are in worse financial shape than you. Just because you have a lot of money, that's not license for you to profiteer off their misery. Okay? And I'm careful I'm shooting an entire industry. Because I'm sure there are times when it really helps people. But, you know, a lot of these kind of like the payday loan things and the title card, title thing places. I mean, some of those are a little shady, you know. Those are a little shady and they charge these folks incredible amount of interest. And then when they can't pay, they come take their car, which might be the only thing they have. Okay, you know. So that's a great point. I will say this, and we won't have time to get into it too much tonight, but when we read about slavery, first of all, in the King James translation, it translates that Hebrew word as servant, not slave. And so some translations translate it as servant, some translate it as slave. And I think we need to recognize that is a very, a trigger word today in our society because of our history with it in America. So, again, you can translate it as Jesus saying, you're going to be a servant, you can say a slave to the devil, or you're going to be a slave to me.
I think when we come into commentary is also making a distinction too that whether you say servant or slave, that many times those were people who were in debt.
Yes. Great
and
point.
And so this was, you know, kind of a justification that they were a servant or a slave.
Right.
So they were indebted to someone.
Yeah.
And so that's a little different way to look at it as well.
That's a great point that I wanted to make. A few years ago, I preached a sermon on Philemon. It's like the whole book, and, you know, it's a short little book, 23 verses, I think, 21, 23 verses. And it's like one of the readings, like the whole book. And the book is Philemon is this runaway slave, and Paul tells him to go back. And you're like, what? You know, like, what? You know, this is good, right? That's your Crown Railroad stuff. But I went into that sermon a little bit, and your point there is exactly. When we say slave or slavery as Americans, we have an image from American history of that. Sometimes not completely accurate, but we have an image. This is what happened. When you read slave in the Bible, if your translation translates it as slave, I think either way has some merit, but I think slave is kind of a loaded word. It's not the same thing as what happened in American slavery. Okay, again, that doesn't justify everything that happened, like you were saying, but these were not people that were generational slaves that were taken from the other side of the world and sold. So what if, again, we're not going to get to it today because hopefully this is useful. We'll go faster next week, I promise. But what does it say there? 7 years, what happens? The slave is free. Is that like American slavery? No. No, you're a slave for the rest of your life unless your owner decides to free you. Your children are slaves. Right. It's generational. That's why they went. As long as we can, and you know what? They had people called indentured servants that were more common actually earlier in colonial America. And guess how long they usually worked? 7 years. Where did they get that? The Bible. Okay, so these are people, they wanted to come to America, but they were too poor. So they basically signed a portion of their life away and said, if you bring me to America, I will work for you for a period of time with no pay. I'm doing this on my own free will. And also usually accompanied when their period of servitude is over, they received land and goods and things like that to start their own life. What happens? They run out of land and they're fighting the Indians and they said, well, let's do slavery instead. Okay, but that's more like what we're talking about here. And one of the laws specifically forbids here, where we're going to read next week, and it also says this in the New Testament, man stealing. It is forbidden in the Old and the New Testament. Now, did it happen? Yes, because people are sinful. But what is God saying? No man stealing. That's much more like American slavery. You know, whether, basically people were captured in Africa, a lot of times by other Africans, and they were sold for money to people from the other side of the world to work, and their children work for the rest of their life. Okay, so I'm not trying to paint a rose-colored glasses picture of these servants and slaves in Israel. What I'm saying, it's not the same. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. So again, when we hear that word, you know, people say, well, God's okay with slavery. You know, how can God be good? It's not even really the same system that we're talking here. It's more of an indentured servitude. Like I said, if you owe debts to someone, and that goes back to this restitution idea, right? Okay, you can file bankruptcy today. You don't have to become an indentured servant. If we did that, there'd probably be a lot fewer bankruptcies, wouldn't there? But you do have bad credit for 7 years. Your name is basically mud for 7 years, right? Because there has to be a penalty, or everybody's going, no, I don't like my bills. This is my bankruptcy. Next one, bankruptcy. So there has to be restitution. So you owe someone money, you could agree to work that off. Okay? So again, not to put on too much rose-colored glasses, but the point is it's not the same thing as what we think of as slavery in American history. And what also, our slavery also is race-based. Okay? It has the race component, right? And that, and we're still feeling that today. Was the slavery in the biblical times necessarily always racial? No. Even the Hebrews, they were slaves of the Egyptians. You say one group of people is enslaving the other. But it's not like they went out and caught a bunch of Hebrews, you know, brought them to Egypt. They were there and then they made them slaves. Okay? So there was an ethnic component to that, more similar to American slavery, but it still wasn't exactly the same. But it was that it was generational.
And you don't know what they're feeling toward the Hebrews, but you don't know if they felt that the Hebrews were an inferior
or just a convenient works
force. Or, you know, you don't know. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know either, but, yeah.
You know, so that's a totally different
situation,
too.
Right. I think there are some more parallels there to American slavery, but it's still not the same. But what we're reading about here in Exodus, and what's going on in the Roman Empire as well, a lot of times, was very different than the American component. So again, it may take a little time, you have a conversation with somebody, but to point some of those things out, and to say, you know, well, when I say slave, what are you thinking of? And they'll probably say this, and say, well, it's not the same thing here. Okay, and even if it was, there's still a lot more. Did slaves in America have any legal protection? No, why? Because did we even consider them human?
Right.
No, they were property. They were like subhuman or just property, and that was the legal argument that was used to say, well, this slave is my property. I can do whatever I want with them, and I can take them wherever I want because they're property. So slaves were not allowed to be educated or, you know, didn't have any legal rights, anything like that. So again, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. All right. That's everything I got on my paper. This was bonus. But hopefully, tell me after class if you don't think it was helpful. But for me, just slogging through all those laws, what's the point?
You didn't have to read.
We will next week. We will. But my hope is, we will next week. We're not skipping any of the other, but my hope is, we won't have to spend an hour on each chapter because, you know, what's the point of this? Okay, so hopefully tonight we've accomplished that. And, you know, if there's any interesting ones, we can talk about it. But I mean, if we went through every law in there, this would be going on for years, and, you know, what would we accomplish? All right, it is time. So any other questions?